Then he proceeded to give the facts. The next time you and I are worrying about what may happen, let's take a tip from wise old Al Smith. Let's examine the record and see what basis there is, if any, for our gnawing anxieties. That's precisely what Frederick J. Malmsteed did when he feared he was lying in his grave. Here's his story as he told it to one of our classes in New York. Early in June 1944, I was lying in a slit trench near Omaha Beach. I was with the 999th Signal Service Company. We'd just dug in Normandy. As I looked around to that slit trench, just a rectangular hole in the ground, I said to myself, "This looks just like a grave." When I lay down and tried to sleep in it, it felt like a grave. I couldn't help saying to myself, "Maybe this is my grave." When the German bombers began coming over at 11 p.m. and the bombs started falling, I was scared stiff. For the first two or three nights, I couldn't sleep at all. By the fourth or fifth night, I was almost a nervous wreck. I knew that if I didn't do something, I would go stark crazy. So I reminded myself that five nights had passed and I was still alive, and so was every man in our outfit. Only two had even been injured, and they had been hurt not by the German bombs, but by falling flak from our own anti-aircraft guns. I decided to stop worrying by doing something constructive. So I built a thick wooden roof over my slit trench to protect myself from flak. I thought of the vast area over which my unit was spread. I told myself that the only way I could be killed in that deep, narrow slit trench was by a direct hit. And I figured out that the chance of a direct hit on me was not 1 in 10,000. After a couple of nights of looking at it in this way, I calmed down and slept even through the bomb raids. The United States Navy used the statistics of the law of averages to buck up the morale of their men. One ex-sailor told me that when he and his shipmates were assigned to high-octane tankers, they were worried stiff. They all believed that if a tanker loaded with high-octane gasoline was hit by a torpedo, it exploded and blew everybody to kingdom come. But the U.S. Navy knew otherwise. So the Navy issued exact figures, showing that out of 100 tankers hit by torpedoes, 60 stayed afloat. And of the 40 that did sink, only 5 sank in less than 10 minutes. That meant time to get off the ship. It also meant casualties were exceedingly small. Did this help morale? This knowledge of the law of averages wiped out my jitters, said Clyde W. Moss of St. Paul, Minnesota, the man who told the story. The whole crew felt better. We knew we had a chance, and that by the law of averages we probably wouldn't be killed. To break the worry habit before it breaks you, here is Rule 3. Let's examine the record. Let's ask ourselves, what are the chances, according to the law of averages, that this event I am worrying about will ever occur? Chapter 9. Cooperate with the inevitable. When I was a little boy, I was playing with some of my friends in the attic of an old abandoned log house in northwest Missouri. As I climbed down out of the attic, I rested my feet on a windowsill for a moment and then jumped. I had a ring on my left forefinger, and as I jumped, the ring caught on a nail head and tore off my finger. I screamed. I was terrified. I was positive I was going to die. But after the hand healed, I never worried about it for one split second. What would have been the use? I accepted the inevitable. And now I often go for a month at a time without even thinking about the fact that I have only 3 fingers and a thumb on my left hand. A few years ago, I met a man who was running a freight elevator in one of the downtown office buildings in New York. I noticed that his left hand had been cut off at the wrist. I asked him if the loss of that hand bothered him. He said, "Oh, no, I hardly ever think about it. I'm not married. The only time I ever think about it is when I try to thread a needle." It's astonishing how quickly we can accept almost any situation, if we have to, and adjust ourselves to it and forget about it. I often think of an inscription on the ruins of a 15th-century cathedral in Amsterdam, Holland. This inscription says, in Flemish, "It is so. It cannot be otherwise." As you and I march across the decades of time, we're going to meet a lot of unpleasant situations that are so. They cannot be otherwise. We have our choice. We can either accept them as inevitable and adjust ourselves to them, or we can ruin our lives with rebellion and maybe end up with a nervous breakdown. Here's a bit of sage advice from one of my favorite philosophers, William James. Be willing to have it so, he said. Acceptance of what has happened is the first step to overcoming the consequences of any misfortune. Elizabeth Conley of Portland, Oregon, had to find that out the hard way. Here's a letter that she wrote me. On the very day that America was celebrating the victory of our armed forces in North Africa, the letter says, I received a telegram from the War Department. My nephew, the person I loved most, was missing in action. A short time later, another telegram arrived saying he was dead. I was prostrate with grief. Up to that time, I had felt that life had been very good to me. I had a job I loved. I'd helped to raise this nephew. He represented to me all that was fine and good in young manhood. I had felt that all the bread I had cast upon the waters was coming back to me as cake. Then came this telegram. My whole world collapsed. I felt there was nothing left to live for. I neglected my work, neglected my friends. I let everything go. I was bitter and resentful. Why did my loving nephew have to be taken? Why did this good boy, with life all before him, why did he have to be killed? I couldn't accept it. My grief was so overwhelming that I decided to give up my work and go away and hide myself in tears and bitterness. I was clearing out my desk, getting ready to quit, when I came across a letter that I had forgotten, a letter from this nephew who had been killed, a letter he'd written to me when my mother had died a few years ago. Of course we will all miss her, the letter said, and especially you, but I know you'll carry on. Your own personal philosophy will make you do that. I shall never forget the beautiful truths you taught me. Wherever I am, or how far apart we may be, I shall always remember that you taught me to smile and to take whatever comes like a man. I read and reread that letter. It seemed as if he were there beside me, speaking to me. He seemed to be saying to me, Why don't you do what you taught me to do? Carry on, no matter what happens. Hide your private sorrows under a smile and carry on. So I went back to my work. I stopped being bitter and rebellious. I kept saying to myself, It is done. I can't change it. But I can and will carry on as he wished me to do. I threw all my mind and strength into my work. I wrote letters to soldiers, to other people's boys. I joined an adult education class at night, seeking out new interests and making new friends. I can hardly believe the change that has come over me. I have ceased mourning over the past that is forever gone. I am living each day now with joy, just as my nephew would have wanted me to do. I have made peace with life. I have accepted my fate. I am now living a fuller and more complete life than I have ever known. Elizabeth Conley learned what all of us will have to learn sooner or later, namely that we must accept and cooperate with the inevitable. It is so, it cannot be otherwise. Now, that's not an easy lesson to learn. Even kings on their thrones have to keep reminding themselves of it. The late George V had these framed words hanging on the wall of his library at Buckingham Palace. Teach me neither to cry for the moon nor over spilt milk. The same thought is expressed by Schopenhauer in this way. A good supply of resignation is of the first importance in providing for the journey of life. Obviously, circumstances alone do not make us happy or unhappy. It is the way we react to circumstances that determines our feelings. Jesus said that the kingdom of heaven is within you. That is where the kingdom of hell is, too. We can all endure disaster and tragedy and triumph over them if we have to. We may not think we can, but we have surprisingly strong inner resources that will see us through if we will only make use of them. We are stronger than we think. The late Booth Tarkington always said, I could take anything that life could force upon me except one thing, blindness. I could never endure that. Then one day, when he was along in his 60s, Tarkington glanced down at the carpet on the floor. The colors were blurred. He couldn't see the pattern. He went to a specialist. He learned the tragic truth. He was losing his sight. One eye was nearly blind, and the other would follow. That which he feared most had come upon him. How did Tarkington react to this worst of all disasters? Did he feel, this is it, this is the end of my life? No. To his amazement, he felt quite gay. He even called upon his humor. Floating specks annoyed him. They would swim across his eyes and cut off his vision. Yet when the largest of these specks would swim across his sight, he would say, "Hello, there's Grandfather again. Wonder where he's going this fine morning." How could fate ever conquer a spirit like that? Well, the answer is, it couldn't. When total darkness closed in, Tarkington said, "I found I could take the loss of my eyesight just as a man can take anything else. If I lost all five of my senses, I know I could live on inside my mind. For it is in the mind we see, and in the mind we live, whether we know it or not." In the hope of restoring his eyesight, Tarkington had to go through more than 12 operations within 1 year, with local anesthetic. Did he rail against this? He knew it had to be done. He knew he couldn't escape it, so the only way to lessen his suffering was to take it with grace. He refused a private room at the hospital and went into a ward where he could be with other people who had troubles too. He tried to cheer them up, and when he had to submit to repeated operations, fully conscious of what was being done to his eyes, he tried to remember how fortunate he was. "How wonderful," he said, "how wonderful that science now has the skill to operate on anything so delicate as the human eye." The average man would have been a nervous wreck if he had had to endure more than 12 operations and blindness. Yet Tarkington said, "I would not exchange this experience for a happier one." It taught him acceptance. It taught him that nothing life could bring him was beyond his strength to endure. It taught him, as John Milton discovered, that it is not miserable to be blind, it is only miserable not to be able to endure blindness. Margaret Fuller, the famous New England feminist, once offered as her credo, "I accept the universe." When grouchy old Thomas Carlyle heard that in England, he snorted, "By gad, she'd better. Yes, and by gad, you and I had better accept the inevitable, too. If we rail and kick against it and grow bitter, we won't change the inevitable, but we will change ourselves. I know. I've tried it. I once refused to accept an inevitable situation with which I was confronted. I played the fool and railed against it and rebelled. It ruined my nights into hells of insomnia. I brought upon myself everything I didn't want. Finally, after a year of self-torture, I had to accept what I knew from the outset I couldn't possibly alter. I should have cried out years ago with old Walt Whitman, 'Oh, to confront night, storms, hunger, ridicule, accident, rebuffs, as the trees and animals do.' I spent 12 years working with cattle, yet I never saw a Jersey cow running a temperature because the pasture was burning up from a lack of rain, or because of sleet and cold, or because her boyfriend was paying too much attention to another heifer. The animals confront night, storms, and hunger calmly, so they never have nervous breakdowns or stomach ulcers, and they never go insane. Am I advocating that we simply bow down to all the adversities that come our way? Not by a long shot. That's mere fatalism. As long as there's a chance we can save a situation, let's fight. But when common sense tells us that we're up against something that is so and cannot be otherwise, then in the name of our sanity, let's not look before and after and pine for what is not. The late Dean Hawkes of Columbia University told me that he had taken a Mother Goose rhyme as one of his mottos. "For every ailment under the sun there is a remedy, or there is none. If there be one, try to find it. If there be none, never mind it." While writing this book, I interviewed a number of the leading business executives of America, and I was impressed by the fact that they cooperated with the inevitable and led lives singularly free from worry. If they hadn't done that, they would have cracked under the strain. Here are a few examples of what I mean. J.C. Penney, founder of the nationwide chain of Penney stores, said to me, "I wouldn't worry if I lost every dollar I have, because I don't see what is to be gained by worrying. I do the best job I possibly can and leave the results in the laps of the gods." Henry Ford told me much the same thing. When I can't handle events, he said, I let them handle themselves. When I asked K.T. Keller, then president of the Chrysler Corporation, how he kept from worrying, he replied, When I'm up against a tough situation, if I can do anything about it, I do it. If I can't, I just forget it. I never worry about the future because I know no man living can possibly figure out what's going to happen in the future. There are so many forces that will affect the future. Nobody can tell what prompts these forces or understands them, so why worry about them? K.T. Keller would be embarrassed if you told him he's a philosopher, he's just a good businessman. Yet he has stumbled onto the same philosophy that Epictetus taught in Rome 19 centuries ago. There is only one way to happiness, Epictetus taught the Romans, and that is to cease worrying about things which are beyond the power of our will. Sarah Bernhardt, the divine Sarah, was an illustrious example of a woman who knew how to cooperate with the inevitable. For half a century, she had been the reigning queen of the theater on four continents, the best-loved actress on earth. Then, when she was 71 and broke, she had lost all her money. Her physician, Professor Posey of Paris, told her he would have to amputate her leg. While crossing the Atlantic, she had fallen on deck during a storm and injured her leg severely. Phlebitis developed. Her leg shrank. The pain became so intense that the doctors felt her leg had to be amputated. He was almost afraid to tell the stormy, tempestuous, divine Sarah what had to be done. He fully expected that the terrible news would set off an explosion of hysteria. But he was wrong. Sarah looked at him a moment and then said quietly, If it has to be, it has to be. It was fate. As she was being wheeled away to the operating room, her son stood weeping. She waved to him with a gay gesture and said cheerfully, Don't go away, I'll be right back. On the way to the operating room, she recited a scene from one of her plays. Someone asked her if she were doing this to cheer herself up. She said, No, to cheer up the doctors and nurses. It will be a strain on them. After recovering from the operation, Sarah Bernhardt went on touring the world and enchanting audiences for another 7 years. When we stop fighting the inevitable, said Elsie McCormick in a Reader's Digest article, we release energy which enables us to create a richer life. No one living has enough emotion and vigor to fight the inevitable, and at the same time enough left over to create a new life. Choose one or the other. You can either bend with the inevitable sleet storms of life, or you can resist them and break. I saw that happen on a farm I own in Missouri. I planted a score of trees on that farm. At first they grew with astonishing rapidity. Then a sleet storm encrusted each twig and branch with a heavy coating of ice. Instead of bowing gracefully to their burden, these trees proudly resisted and broke and split under the load and had to be destroyed. They hadn't learned the wisdom of the forests of the North. I've traveled hundreds of miles through the evergreen forests of Canada, yet I have never seen a spruce or a pine broken by sleet or ice. These evergreen forests know how to bend, how to bow down their branches, how to cooperate with the inevitable. The masters of jiu-jitsu teach their pupils to bend like the willow, don't resist like the oak. Why do you think your automobile tires stand up on the road and take so much punishment? At first, the tire manufacturers tried to make a tire that would resist the shocks of the road. It was soon cut to ribbons. Then they made a tire that would absorb the shocks of the road. That tire could take it. You and I will last longer and enjoy smoother riding if we learn to absorb the shocks and jolts along the rocky road of life. What will happen to you and me if we resist the shocks of life instead of absorbing them? What will happen if we refuse to bend like the willow and insist on resisting like the oak? The answer is easy. We will set up a series of inner conflicts. We will be worried, tense, strained, and neurotic. If we go still further and reject the harsh world of reality and retreat into a dream world of our own making, we will then be insane. During the war, millions of frightened soldiers had either to accept the inevitable or break under the strain. To illustrate, let's take the case of William H. Cassilis of Glendale, New York. Here's a prize-winning talk he gave before one of my classes in New York. Shortly after I joined the Coast Guard, I was assigned to one of the hottest spots on this side of the Atlantic. I was made a supervisor of explosives. Imagine it, me, a cracker salesman, becoming a supervisor of explosives. The very thought of finding yourself standing on top of thousands of tons of TNT is enough to chill the marrow in a cracker salesman's bones. I was given only 2 days of instruction, and what I learned filled me with even more terror. I'll never forget my first assignment. On a dark, cold, foggy day, I was given my orders on the open pier of Caven Point, Bayonne, New Jersey. I was assigned to hold number 5 on my ship. I had to work down in that hold with 5 longshoremen. They had strong backs, but they knew nothing whatever about explosives, and they were loading blockbusters, each one of which contained a ton of TNT, enough explosive to blow that old ship to kingdom come. These blockbusters were being lowered by 2 cable slings. I kept saying to myself, suppose one of those cables slipped or broke. Oh, boy, I was scared. I trembled, my mouth was dry, my knees sagged, my heart pounded. But I couldn't run away. That would be desertion. I would be disgraced. My parents would be disgraced, and I might be shot for desertion. I couldn't run. I had to stay. I kept looking at the careless way those longshoremen were handling those blockbusters. The ship might blow up any minute. After an hour or more of this spine-chilling terror, I began to use a little common sense. I gave myself a good talking to. I said, look here, so you're blown up, so what? You'll never know the difference. It'll be an easy way to die, much better than dying by cancer. Don't be a fool. You can't expect to live forever. You've got to do this job or be shot, so you might as well like it. I talked to myself like that for hours, and I began to feel at ease. Finally, I overcame my worry and fears by forcing myself to accept an inevitable situation. I'll never forget that lesson. Every time I'm tempted now to worry about something I can't possibly change, I shrug my shoulders and say, forget it. I find that it works, even for a cracker salesman. Hooray, let's give 3 cheers and 1 cheer more for the cracker salesman of the Pinafore. Outside the crucifixion of Jesus, the most famous death scene in all history was the death of Socrates. 10,000 centuries from now, men will still be reading and cherishing Plato's immortal description of it, one of the most moving and beautiful passages in all literature. Certain men of Athens, jealous and envious of old barefooted Socrates, trumped up charges against him and had him tried and condemned to death. When the friendly jailer gave Socrates the poison cup to drink, the jailer said, "Try to bear lightly what needs must be." Socrates did. He faced death with a calmness and resignation that touched the hem of divinity. Try to bear lightly what needs must be. Those words were spoken 399 years before Christ was born, but this worrying old world needs those words today more than ever before. Try to bear lightly what needs must be. I've been reading practically every book and magazine article I could find that dealt, even remotely, with banishing worry. Would you like to know what the best single bit of advice about worry that I've discovered in all that reading? Well, here it is, summed up in 27 words, words that you and I ought to paste on our bathroom mirror so that each time we wash our faces, we could also wash away all worry from our minds. This priceless prayer was written by Dr. Reinhold Niebuhr. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. To break the worry habit before it breaks you, Rule 4 is cooperate with the inevitable. Chapter 10. Put a stop-loss order on your worries. Would you like to know how to make money in Wall Street? Well, so would a million other people, and if I knew the answer, this book would sell for $10,000 a copy. However, there's one good idea that some successful operators use. This story was told to me by Charles Roberts, an investment counselor. I originally came up to New York from Texas with $20,000, which my friends had given me to invest in the stock market, Charles Roberts told me. I thought, he continued, that I knew the ropes in the stock market, but I lost every cent. True, I made a lot of profits on some deals, but I ended up by losing everything. I did not mind so much losing my own money, Mr. Roberts explained, but I felt terrible about having lost my friends' money, even though they could well afford it. I dreaded facing them again after our venture had turned out so unfortunately, but to my astonishment, they not only were good sports about it, but proved to be incurable optimists. I knew I'd been trading on a hit-or-miss basis, and depending largely on luck and other people's opinions, I had been playing the stock market by ear. I began to think over my mistakes, and I determined that before I went back into the market again, I would try to find out what it was all about. So I sought out and became acquainted with one of the most successful speculators who ever lived, Burton S. Castles. I believed I could learn a great deal from him because he had long enjoyed the reputation of being successful year after year, and I knew that such a career was not the result of mere chance or luck. He asked me a few questions about how I had traded before, then told me what I believe is the most important principle in trading. He said, "I put a stop-loss order on every market commitment I make. If I buy a stock at, say, $50 a share, I immediately place a stop-loss order on it at $45. That means that when and if the stock should decline by as much as 5 points below its cost, it would be sold automatically, thereby limiting the loss to 5 points. If your commitments are intelligently made in the first place," the old master continued, "your profits will average 10, 25, or even 50 points. Consequently, by limiting your losses to 5 points, you can be wrong more than half the time and still make plenty of money." I adopted that principle immediately and have used it ever since. It has saved my clients and me many thousands of dollars. After a while, I realized that the stop-loss principle could be used in other ways besides in the stock market. I began to place stop-loss orders on other worries besides financial ones. I began to place a stop-loss order on any and every kind of annoyance and resentment that came to me. It has worked like magic. For example, I often have a luncheon date with a friend who's rarely on time. In the old days, he used to keep me stewing around for half my lunch hours before he showed up. Finally, I told him about my stop-loss orders on my worries. I said, "Bill, my stop-loss order on waiting for you is exactly 10 minutes. If you arrive more than 10 minutes late, our luncheon engagement will be sold down the river, and I'll be gone." Man alive, how I wish I had the sense years ago to put stop-loss orders on my impatience, on my temper, on my desire for self-justification, on my regrets, and on all my mental and emotional strains. Why didn't I have the horse sense to size up each situation that threatened to destroy my peace of mind and say to myself, "See here, Dale Carnegie, this situation is worth just so much fussing about and no more"? Why didn't I? However, I must give myself credit for a little sense on one occasion at least. And it was a serious occasion, too, a crisis in my life, a crisis when I stood watching my dreams and my plans for the future and the work of years vanish into thin air. It happened like this. In my early 30s, I decided to spend my life writing novels. I was going to be a second Frank Narrowist or Jack London or Thomas Hardy. I was so in earnest that I spent 2 years in Europe, where I could live cheaply with dollars during the period of wild printing press money that followed the First World War. I spent 2 years there, writing my magnum opus. I called it The Blizzard. The title was a natural, for the reception it got among the publishers was as cold as any blizzard that ever howled across the plains of the Dakotas. When my literary agent told me it was worthless, that I had no gift, no talent for fiction, my heart almost stopped. I left his office in a daze. I couldn't have been more stunned if he had hit me across the head with a club. I was stupefied. I realized that I was standing at the crossroads of life and had to make a tremendous decision. Which way should I turn? Weeks passed before I came out of the daze. At that time, I had never heard of the phrase, put a stop-loss order on your worries, but as I look back now, I can see that I did just that. I wrote off my 2 years of sweating over that novel for just what they were worth, a noble experiment, and went forward from there. I returned to my work of organizing and teaching adult education classes, and wrote biographies in my spare time, biographies and novels.